Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
My father was fired. He was technologically unemployed. My father worked for the same firm for 12 years. They fired him. They replaced him with a tiny gadget this big. It does everything that my father does, only it does it much better. The depressing thing is my mother ran out and bought one.
Where would we be today without innovation?
Well, we'd have less pollution. We'd have fewer hungry people.
Innovative torture methods. Innovative weapons. Innovative surveillance.
How could we not innovate?
Doesn't innovation just bring on problems that require more so-called innovation to solve?
Our guest is Kristin Salas, author of Innovation and Scaling for Impact.
Will innovation kill us? Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. A program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Stanford University over at Philosopher's Corner. That's where I taught in the philosophy department for a long, long time, and Ken is still teaching.
Yeah, still hanging in there. And the question of the day, the burning question of the hour, will innovation kill us?
Probably. That would be the optimistic answer. Probably. Take climate change. We can thank that fantastic piece of innovation, the Industrial Revolution, for that. Case closed, I think.
Oh, John, come on. Innovation is the key to surviving climate change and warding it off. And fortunately, we're already moving in that direction. Not fast enough, but we're moving the wind and solar energy. You know, so we need more innovation now, not less.
Innovation got us into this mess, Ken. What makes you, you Pollyanna, think it's going to get us out?
Well, I don't know what else we can do. You just can't ride out climate change. But look, think of life without innovation. I mean, you diss the Industrial Revolution, but life without the Industrial Revolution would be a mess. It would be hardly recognizable as human life is today.
Well, we've gained a lot from human innovation, no doubt about that. But consider the cost. Innovation just creates new problems that require more innovation to fix. Where's it all going to end? Extinction.
Oh, gosh, it sounds... Look, the consequences of what you're saying sounds like you want us to give up all of modernity, all modern conveniences, and go back to what, living in the Pleistocene and the Stone Age and the Savannah and caves or something?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go for that. But we do need to return some of the old ways of doing things if we're going to survive on this planet. Take agriculture, for example.
Yeah, one of the biggest innovation of all time, you know, that substantially improved human health and human life expectancy.
Well, that's a kind of a narrow point, Ken. I mean, there's a lot more life on Earth than humans, and the human agriculture revolution was a disaster for most of it. But given that, even that has gone from small farms to huge industrialized facilities. Livestock are pumped with antibiotics, and then they pump out methane to warm up the globe. Crops are sprayed with pesticide.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to grant you, I'm not going to deny that innovations have unforeseen negative consequences. Look, nothing in life is an unmixed blessing. But does that make innovation like an intrinsically bad thing? I mean, you really think we should stop innovating? Huh? Haven't you ever heard that old saying, innovate or die?
Well, at least we could think critically about it. In this part of the world, Silicon Valley, people fetishize innovation.
Fetishize? Celebrate is a better word, John. Celebrate.
Oh, come on. Now, think smartphones. What a disaster. Why do we... I mean, we had those black Bakelite phones for most of my life, the same one. Now we need to constantly replace and upgrade our old phones, or everybody makes fun of us. Why? So we can spend more time staring at bigger and better screens and playing more sophisticated Sudokus instead of interacting with friends and family. And what happens to all those old digital devices after a year or two? They end up in a landfill. That's what innovation gets you, Ken. More junk.
No, John,
it's called planned obsolescence.
No, John, you're targeting the wrong thing. It's not innovation that's the problem. It's consumerist capitalism. You've got a beef with consumerist capitalism. That's all.
Consumer capitalism creates innovation, feeds innovation, because it needs innovation and it feeds off innovation. Why? To make human life better? No, to make old products obsolete so they can sell us more stuff.
But you don't dump the baby with the bathwater or whatever that saying is. Because think, some innovations are really crucial. Think of hygiene.
In California, Ken, it's don't throw out the bathwater with the baby. We're in a drought.
Yeah, right. Think of hygiene and medicine or social innovation, like giving women and minorities equal rights. Innovation and human progress, John, they go hand in hand. If you're against innovation, you're against progress.
Well, I'm not saying that all innovation is bad, but we ought to focus on changes that help the human condition, not innovations that create more junk in order to create more profit. The gap between rich and poor has grown with our innovative Silicon Valley-based economy. Right now, innovation is making that gap bigger and bigger. Think of how you buy a book. You don't go to someone who earns about as much as you, some middle-class person, and buy a book from him, the bookseller or her. No, you put money into Jeff Bezos' pocket, and there's barely room for the money in his pocket. Is that progress? If so, you can stuff it.
Well, look, John, I'm going to grant you, like everything else, innovation has its upsides and its downsides. Some things we love, some things we hate. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to find out which technologies people have a love-hate relationship with. She files this report.
In the late 18th century, most families worked in the fields. Their ancestors worked in the fields. But they never owned their own land. There was a small number of aristocratic landowners, and everyone else worked for them. 300 years later, we still have a small number of wealthy people, and everyone else works for them. But we've also had a lot of innovation, like when our farmworking ancestors entered the Industrial Revolution.
Inventors had found new ways to harness nature's energy. They built new kinds of machines, powered by water, steam, and coal.
That's a scene from Bill Blakemore's Turning Points in History. During the Industrial Revolution, people moved out of their ancestral homes and into big cities. They left the farms and started working the assembly lines. It was innovation, but it came at a price.
Pollution from coal-powered factories turned the cities black. Lack of housing created the first urban slums. And the demand for more and more goods and higher profits brought the exploitation of workers, including children.
But there are other, newer innovations that have no negative consequences at all.
Welcome to Bank of America.
Take automated call centers, for example. Who doesn't love those?
Please say or enter your telephone access ID.
Operator.
Or your card or account number.
Operator.
Please say yes or no. You'd like to speak with an associate. Is that right?
Yes.
To better assist you, please tell me what you're calling about today.
Forget this. And that's just part of the tech boom. The folks in Silicon Valley are the new pioneers in innovation. Apps are where it's at, as is eloquently displayed in the sitcom, Silicon Valley.
Yo, 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 just want to thank everyone for coming out to this Kickstarter party for Bro, the app that proves that you can change the world in just one word.
Actually, it's just half a word.
I know, so efficient.
These days, innovation means technology. So I asked a few people, what technologies do you love the most?
My favorite piece of technology is iPhone 6.
Digital video cameras.
Electronic health records.
My favorite technology is Snapchat, which is like a social media app where you can send pictures or videos to your friends.
But just like the Industrial Revolution, our beloved innovations have a dark side. Take video cameras.
What annoys me the most is just how fast and how often they're coming out with newer versions that sort of make the old ones obsolete.
And electronic health records.
I hate the clicking and the, you know, the imperfections, like, wow, why can't you just get from one thing to the other without clicking this and opening that window and clicking that?
Even Snapchat has a downside.
Whatever you send or take pictures of, it will, like, get saved in Snapchat, but you can't see it. The people who created Snapchat will be able to see it forever.
There's this fear with all new technologies is, you know, especially if you work with technology, when is the human operator going to become obsolete?
The Industrial Revolution changed how we worked, from the fields to the factories.
It brought about a worldwide economic boom, but it also decentralized families and increased child labor. Today's tech revolution moved us from the factories to the computer screens. Global markets now navigate through the World Wide Web. But we also have less human contact and more carpal tunnel syndrome. That doesn't make computers evil or great, because innovation isn't innately bad or good. But what do I know? I'm just the roving philosophical reporter. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Just the roving philosophical reporter. Don't diminish that great report, which reminded us, cheered us up, made us feel good about all the misery technology causes. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about whether we're being killed or saved by innovation. We're joined now by Kristin Salos. He's a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. He's author of the forthcoming Innovation and Scaling for Impact, How Effective Social Enterprises Do It. Kristin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
John, Ken, thanks so much for having me. It's a great show. I love to be here.
Thanks so much. Now, Kristin, you've worked in a lot of different areas. They're all over my head. But anyway, molecular biology, gemini, to the social sector and international business. Now, how in this career, what got you off on the topic of innovation?
Fascinating. I was a lab rat, being obsessed with understanding diseases and problems very, very deeply. And then I switched over to the management sciences, and I see this obsession with solutions and innovations. We keep adding layers of solutions over problems until we don't see them anymore. And I'm wondering what is a healthy balance between solution obsession and problem obsession. So it really makes me think.
That's interesting. I'm glad it got you thinking. Now, when somebody calls an idea innovative, it's usually meant as a compliment. But it isn't always a good thing, as you point out in your book, and as we heard about the Industrial Revolution on Shuka's piece. Now, what's your favorite example of an innovation with disastrous effects?
I think there are lots of great ones. Unfortunately, one of my favorite probably is, you know, the invention of antibiotics that created so many benefits for so many people. But if you think about it, now we have bugs that are resistant to all known antibiotics. So we have to invent ever more sophisticated ways to kill them before they kill us. We have hospital superbugs that are really, really becoming concerning.
Hospital superbugs. I was reading something about the history of the hospital. And the early hospitals apparently were places basically you went to die because they didn't know about bacteria and all this stuff. Right. Okay. Then they know about bacteria and they create the antibiotics, as you say, and hospitals go places and you don't die. But now hospital superbugs, which are in hospitals, they're again places where I know a guy who went in for a knee replacement and he died, not because of the knee replacement, but because of an infection. Right. I mean, so am I right about that? I mean, hospitals are now places where you risk death because of innovation?
Well, regardless, I'm glad I don't have to go to hospitals too often, yes.
Mm-hmm. Best to go to a surgery center, I guess.
But unbalanced. But unbalanced, though. The hospital and antibiotics. Well, they're a profoundly good thing, right? I mean, the cost doesn't begin to outweigh the benefits. Wouldn't you agree with that, or would you not agree with that?
It's really hard because that would require a serious evaluation of what would have been alternatives towards producing and allocating so many resources into antibiotics. Would, you know, if maybe a more reflective medicine would have created alternatives in time to antibiotics, so we wouldn't actually be in the situation that we are in. A lot of innovation is necessary because we're waiting too long with adaptations and solving the problems we have.
So when people think about innovation, it seems to me there's always this difference when you think about it from the personal point of view. Yeah, antibiotics are good for me. But to step back and say in 100, 200 years, will they turn out to have been, on balance, a good thing? It's a hard problem.
Well, it's a very hard problem when you put it that way. And we're going to have to dig into that hard problem in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about whether innovation will actually kill us with Kristin Salos from the Stanford Center for Philanthropy and Civil Society.
Is innovation an essential part of human nature? Could we ever stop it? And if we can't, what direction is innovation taking us?
Innovation, human nature, and our future on this planet. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Pictures came and broke your heart.
Video killed the radio star. Amazon killed the bookstore. We're asking the question, is innovation going to kill us? According to the Buggles, it did a good job on radio, but what's next? I'm John Perry. We're on the radio. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking the urgent question, will innovation kill us?
Our guest is Christian Salos, author of Innovation and Scaling for Impact, a forthcoming book that we're all going to want to run out and buy. And Christian will be part of a live chat on our online community of thinkers on Wednesday, November 18th at 1 p.m. Pacific time. Join us and talk with this interesting fellow, philosophytalk.org.
Now, Christian, the case of the antibiotic is really fascinating. I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about that. But first, I'm going to ask you a more global question. Okay, I'm going to grant that innovations can have many unanticipated consequences. The way we used and distributed antibiotics was a great case in point. But then to deal with those unanticipated downside consequences, we usually have to innovate more. So aren't we in a cycle in which innovation is inescapable for us now in the 21st century? It's just inescapable.
It seems like, right, also if we reflect that, you know, innovation is fueled by this rhetoric of speed, innovation, acceleration, faster progress, disruption. It seems like we're driving a car faster and faster. But what happens if you drive a car really, really fast? You're prone to make many more mistakes, failures, accidents. And the cost of these accidents at higher speeds is much more damaging than at lower speeds. So I think in a way we're stuck in this speed rhetoric. And that we see this reflected in the policy making decisions at the public sector. We see this in companies. We see this in entrepreneurship and everywhere, even in the development sector where I do my research. And it seems
so. You think it all needs to slow down, right? And all needs to be more thoughtful, sort of like scientific research. You said you came from a problem solving thing. I know how science works. It's slow and methodical, and weighing all possibilities and seeing what the alternative are. And you think kind of like the innovation cycle needs to be more like that, or something like that, more incremental, more piecemeal.
I wouldn't call it incremental, but more reflective. There, you know, when we observe impactful social sector organizations, where I do a lot of research, we see them doing something that I call continuous reflective advancement. They ask a broader set of questions. They're slowing down because they only want to make progress at the speed that they can learn about potential mistakes, potential side effects. So it's a very different approach towards innovation. Yes.
Well, take the internet. Now, we all love the internet. You know, love, hate, maybe, but we all love it. We all enjoy it. It brings many benefits. But what are the biggest impacts it's had? I would guess terrorism and pornography. They could have figured that out before they sprung the internet on us, but I don't know what kind of mechanism would cause people to slow down. We don't want a world czar that's insists on an innovation impact. Well, maybe we do.
Well, I want to add on to John before you respond. I want to add on because I was thinking along the very same lines. Look, if I'm a company in a highly competitive marketplace, the pressure to innovate, to give a new product that nobody's got, is huge, right? It is innovate or lose market share, right? So, and if I'm a social organization, in competitive environments at least, it's hard to slow down, isn't it? So I wonder, how could you slow down? And even in social environments in which people have these deeply urgent needs, it's like, I don't want to wait until next year. Now, give it to me now.
Companies is a great example. Let's just look at companies for an example, right? Companies are stuck. They have to innovate because it's built into their share prices. They are multiples of current asset values. So you have to innovate. So maybe the solution is not so much, you know, changing companies, but thinking about more structural variation. We have now more variants in organizational forms. We have hybrid organizations that combine elements of for-profit and the not-for-profit sector. We have B corporations. We have social enterprises. These types of organizations can ask a broader set of questions. They also have capital that is a little bit more patient.
Okay, so slow down for a second. So suppose I'm a company. I'm starting a startup company. I'm thinking about how to organize myself. I'm not quite sure what you're telling me because I want to dominate the market. I want to win market share. Are you telling me that if I organize myself in a way that's more reflective, I'll be able to do that? It sounds like you're telling me if I do that, I'll maybe have less downside social consequences, but I want the market share.
Exactly right. And you have to. There's no choice. If you're not going to do it, they will find a CEO who is willing to do it. Right. So that's why I'm saying for companies per se that are owned by shareholders, there may be no way out of the innovation route. But maybe we can allocate more resources to different types of companies, such as B corporations or hybrid corporations and social enterprises.
Now, let's just take a minute and say a B corporation is...
A B corporation is a new legal form where corporations have the much more freedom of choices. They can ask a broader question. They are not legally required to maximize returns on investments or profits. They, at the same priority, they ask questions about social impact and environmental impact. It's a much more patient form of organizing.
It sounds like what corporations were when they were first invented, and you had to have a charter from the government to explain that how you're going to do good. But speaking of the government, we have the Environmental Protection Agency that slows down change and insists that you do lots of things that are good in themselves, like figuring out what the impact is going to be, and all. They also just slow everything down. Can we have an innovation or a social life or, you know, long-term impact on everything part of government that slows corporations down? I'm trying to figure out what would be maximally irritating to Donald Trump and assume it's a good idea. So maybe that's a good idea.
It's a question whether we can actually limit the negative consequences of innovation through just coercive measures and legal measures. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could also give more opportunities and options for people who have really good intentions to ask a broader set of questions to make an impact, not just in the financial sector, but in the social and environmental sector.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking whether innovation will actually kill us. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Gus in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gus.
Thank you.
What's your comment or question?
I just had a question about the philosophy of Heidegger regarding innovation. Heidegger theorized that there were two kinds of thinking. Thinking that you do for itself, like philosophizing, and calculative thinking, which is thinking to reach a goal, in a sense, sort of along the lines of innovation. Would this sort of infinite chain of innovation that you were talking about, do you think that ultimately this is going to put philosophers like you out of a job with the lack of contemplative thinking for itself in society?
I don't know. John, you know something about Heidegger more than I do, so I'm not sure how to answer that.
Well, Heidegger had a lot of good ideas, I've come to think, somewhat reluctantly. He himself was quite an innovator, though. He innovated linguistically. So a lot of his good ideas are buried in innovative words he made up in German and some in Greek that provide a barrier. But, you know, I don't worry about philosophers being innovated out of business like booksellers. But because I think it's like food. You got to have it if you're a human being.
I do worry about something, though, and innovation and human labor. There were people who sincerely believe, that in the not-too-distant future, all the work that's currently being done, or a great deal of the work that's currently being done by humans, will be done by machines. I was, when I was in college, a spot welder in a Ford assembly line a long time ago. I learned recently, because of this controversy about Rubio and welders versus philosophers, that the kind of job that I did in college is no longer done anywhere by human beings. That all these car manufacturing have gone to robotic spot welding assembly lines. This is all human. No human does what I did in college.
I remember the great Taylor recall where Ford had to bring every car you worked on back and fix it.
There are serious people who think the day is coming when almost anything a human can do, a machine will be able to do more efficiently, cheaper, blah, blah. What's going to happen to us when we innovate our way out of labor? What do you think?
So I'm not sure, but what you're making is the link to the ultimate, you know, the ultimate threat, existential threat of innovation, right? There's a lot of talk now about artificial intelligence and innovation going on in genetic mutation. They are going to the core of who we are as a species on this planet. Now, I don't have answers for your question. I cannot predict the future, but clearly these things ought to be on our mind because people who are much smarter than I am are saying, you know, these are real, real threats to the human race, not just to industries or companies.
So, but how do we collectively think about that? I mean, John suggested maybe it's the government's job to somehow slow us down and make us think about that. Does the government do that kind of thing in advanced industrial democracies? Don't the governments mostly serve corporations rather than constrain them?
So here's the problem that I see in that regard with governance. We ought to democratize policy setting again, because at the moment, there's too much lobbying influence strategies going on from industries and lobbyists. At the moment, at the EU, we have a working group that organizes the pollution standards for coal-fired power plants. The representatives, most of the representatives, come from the energy industry at the moment. They're setting their own standards. Right? As long as we have these non-democratic policy-setting circumstances, I have little hope that we're going to escape these problems.
No. But aren't there some fundamental questions here? Like, we have freedom of speech, and people usually interpret that to be freedom of research, unless you're torturing an animal or killing a human or something. But now we're doing research on stuff that isn't exactly dangerous like that, but it has more subtle dangers. Like, who knows what cloning, what the long-term consequences of cloning is going to be. Philosophers think about it, but one of the problems is that innovation on the side of government, innovation on the side of institutions to control the bad consequences, is much slower than innovation that causes them.
You know, that's why I liked my time in the molecular biology sciences so much, because we really spent sufficient time of understanding these problems much, much more deeply. And that is a slower process than believing that the solutions are going to help us all the time. But how do we slow things down? We are living in a very fast-paced world. I don't know how to slow it down unless we fundamentally change of our you know, public sector decision-making processes and the private sector decision-making processes. But I don't know how to do it.
Well, we've got some interesting email from John that's probably not going to solve all of our problems. Bertrand Russell, he says, in his later writings, argued that until nuclear weapons are destroyed and banned, all human innovation is suspect as a contributing cause of the eventual use of these lethal weapons. Well, I don't remember Russell saying that, but it sounds like something he would have said, and not a bad idea. And in fact, microelectronics, John goes on, of the most up-to-date levels are being used in just such pernicious ways. What about that?
So here is a thought. You know, the obvious problem is that innovation enables both good and bad intentions. Right? What is the distribution of good and bad intentions right. In this world? Are we getting morally better? Is our ethical fiber getting stronger or weaker? That's a difficult question that I don't know.
See, the thing I think that many, especially here in Silicon Valley, and I have come to be deeply skeptical about the following. I think many people believe in what I call technological determinism. That is, the technology on its own, innovative technology, determines our future, right? But technology is in a way inert until we use it, deploy it in certain social settings. And we hardly ever think about the social setting, the broad social and political and cultural setting in which this technology is going to be deployed and constrained. And we're very unreflective about that. We kind of let the technology do its thing without much reflection. And it seems like your work is asking us to be much more reflective about.
Absolutely. And it's not just social issues. It's also environmental issues. Remember, we have polluted outer space. NASA is tracking 500,000 of space junk at the moment that creates really, really dangerous implications for space travel and other things. So not only have we polluted our planet through a lot of innovation and consumerism, but we're polluting outer space as well.
Well, it's kind of inspiring, isn't it? I mean, humans have gone way beyond where they could have dreamt years ago when just polluting lakes and setting Lake Erie on
it's
fire
like Star Trek.
Back in Ken's, near Ken's hometown was enough. Now we can actually pollute space.
It's like Star Trek.
Maybe we'll be able to pollute other galaxies if we work hard enough.
It's like Star Trek. They talk about going where no man has gone before. Now we have junk that goes where no junk has gone before. We got a comment on Twitter. Somebody's following us on Twitter. Joshua says, civilization is a hopeless race to discover remedies for the evils it produces. Now, you think that's an overstatement, that civilization is a hopeless race to overcome evils that it itself produced? Or is that?
It's Rousseau that said that.
Yeah.
My God, that's really a philosophical question, right? Yeah. I wish I was a philosopher to have a good answer to that. I'm a realist scholar. You know, I think reality has little patience for well-intended ignorance. So I insist we need to remove ignorance and not just rely on either coercive measures or well intentions. We need to combine all of those things.
You teach in business schools, or you've taught in business?
Yes,
right? So how do business students react to the kind of things that you teach? Because business is a place where innovation, new now. I mean, how do business schools and your business colleagues
So the interesting thing, I don't want to generalize too much, but I teach both in MBA courses at business schools, but also, for example, at the School of Governance, where I have a very different student population, not just coming from the private sector. In business schools, innovation is basically taken for granted. I don't need to explain that. It's just a matter of how can we innovate faster and better than our competitors? That's the name of the game. When I teach a course, for example, I teach a sustainable development course in a School of Governance, the students are much more reflective about the implications of innovation for sustainable development, for social and environmental progress. Very, very different types of discourses in the classroom. I think there is hope of educating a generation that is in a much more reflective mode than the typical business school manager that we are educating. And there are lots of smart and reflective guys in business schools, but in general, we're teaching still the same old innovation is good ideology.
So I still want to go back to how do we get more. So it sounds like your teaching, at least to certain kinds of your students, makes a difference. But, I mean, is it just that the business model just is not, unless it's forced by, you say you don't want coercive measures, but unless there's something top down from the civil society or the government or something, the thinking won't change in industry, business and industry. And that's where a lot of the pressure for innovative products that end up polluting the environment and all that stuff comes from.
Yeah. That's why I think it's so important that we don't try to change things through just coercive measures, but provide people with alternatives, other ways of doing things. So I'm coming back to when my colleague Johanna Meyer and I taught the first social enterprise course at the business school in Europe about 15 years ago. Students afterwards told us, this is great. I had no idea that I could have different career opportunities. I don't have to go into consulting or investment banking. I can go into social enterprise. You can have a good salary there too. You can create even financial value, but also a broader set of impact on society. So by showing them alternatives and opportunities, I think is a really, really good way of making progress.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about innovation and its dangers with Christian Salos from the Stanford Center for Philanthropy and Civil Society.
Can innovation solve global poverty? Or do we need to stick with what we've got? And what's the right balance between innovation and traditional approaches when it comes to making the world a better place?
Innovation and global poverty when Philosophy Talk continues.
Innovators see nothing but a bright future ahead. But what about the people left behind in innovation's wake? All us seniors that can't use our phones anymore. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Christian Salos. He's author of the forthcoming Innovation and Scaling for Impact. We're asking whether innovation will kill us. You can be part of a live chat with Christian at our online community of thinkers on Wednesday, November 18th at 1 p.m. Pacific time. That's Wednesday, November 18th, 1 p.m. Join us for our online chat at philosophytalk.org.
So here's email from Barbara in El Sobrante. Let's start with that. Often innovation is sold as a solution to a problem with no consideration of long-term consequence of the pollution that goes into producing, that results from disposing of the innovated product in order to purchase the newest innovation. The real cost of the new is never factored in. Let me add to that. When we think about innovation, when I talk to people about innovation and its cost, I get this response, well, you know, would you want to live in a world without cell phones? Would you want to live in a world without computers? That's kind of a irrelevant question. Back in the days of typewriters, I didn't miss computers. Back in the days of black telephones that sat on the desk, I didn't miss cell phones. So this kind of taking the people who benefited from the innovation and saying, would you want to do without it, is one question, but it's kind of not the important question, is it, Christian? Isn't the important question is, what's this going to do in the long run?
That's right. One of the challenges is that there is a hope that innovation will create a better world, a more sustainable world, societal change. And the problem is that if you drive a car faster, but you have no consensus over the direction, you may just end up where you don't want to be faster. If I look at the state of the world right now, I think it's a mess. is this the world we really wanted to create? I'm not so sure. So again, you know, the speed is the problem because it prevents us from reflecting where we want to go and how we want to get there.
So let me, but I want to go back to John's thing. I think he made a point that it's kind of the wrong question to ask whether we who have this stuff would give it up and go back to where we were, as opposed to whether we who didn't have this stuff would demand it. I was listening to a conference about whether innovation is unbalanced, good or bad, people on all sides. And one person said, well, here's the thing you have to do if you're a business person. You have to get yourself in the skin of the consumer. That's not to say you ask them, what would you like? But you have to know what it's like to be a consumer so that you can know how this consumer might respond to a product you're imagining. So this consumer might not think, oh, I need a cell phone. I need a thing with it. But you getting yourself into the skin of the experiential skin of the consumer, he says, you see forward what they would like and you invent that and you make lots of money and that's how you get rich. So John, yeah, sure, maybe you wouldn't have demanded, but a really clever thinker said, yeah, I'm going to invent myself a smartphone and he's going to love it. Yeah. What do you think of that?
No, and it's great, and it's in fact true. The thing is that we actually invent consumer needs. We produce things that consumers didn't even know they wanted, and maybe they never wanted it. But now that we have it, or that they can buy it, now they want it. The question is one of moral philosophy. Is this good in the long run from an ethical perspective? But the other one is a much more pragmatic. You know, can we afford the material resources that go into these products that have a planned obsolescence and are gonna fail in 2 years' time? When we are dumping 8 million tons of plastic waste every year into the ocean, for example, right? So it's a much broader set of questions we need to consider, not just whether the consumer is happy or willing to pay for that or not.
Now, in this respect, you've mentioned before, and you do a lot of research on charitable organizations, non-governmental organizations, alternative kinds of corporations, and other groups that are trying to solve some of these problems. Now, they have kind of a marginal role in our lives. You see them as having a much bigger role, or do you think that's possible? And how about in the social sector? Isn't there an innovation crisis there too?
Yeah, I really hope they play more of a role, or at least we can learn something of the ways they operate. They are not all good, by the way, but some are good and we can learn something from them. You know, in the poverty sector, it's fascinating. You go to poverty conference, and they now all have slogans like, we need to accelerate innovation for faster progress. You leave these conferences, you think poverty will be eliminated in 5 years' time because of all this innovation. I think it's ridiculous. Again, it's this solution focus where we're not willing to deal with the root causes of poverty and how to go about it.
You know, I don't know how I feel about capitalism, but this conversation is making me think that something I said in the opening, John said, well, capitalism feeds on innovation like a drug or something like that, right? It needs innovation. It pumps, it creates consumer demand so they can sell stuff and make more money and all that sort of stuff. And we've been talking about how we could have a system that was slower and more thoughtful and more reflective. I mean, maybe capitalism is itself part of the problem. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, that's a large thought. We can't do justice to it in a couple minutes. But you could think that that the economic organization, the economic context in which innovations are created and produced and consumed, that's part of the problem. You can't just look at innovation. You have to look at the whole system.
Yeah, I don't think there's, capitalism per se is not capital per se is not the problem. Capitalism, the way we use capital, is of course the problem. But remember, capitalism was in a way emerging at a time when there was no concern about environmental pollution. We had plenty of resources of all kinds. There was space for human people. There were plenty of opportunities. I think spaces are narrowing right now. We don't have an infinite amount of resources available for our disposal. So we need to think more reflectively how we use capital, for which ends, right, and which means are justified by those ends.
It sounds to me like we have just like we have with global warming, we have a new collective action problem that we never had before, right? With global warming, I mean, when individual actors were making their individual decisions, nobody could foresee, and there was no agency that was designed to foresee the aggregated consequences of these problems. Now we have all these problems. So the aggregated consequences of all these individual local solutions is huge and tremendous. And we've got this huge collective action problem connected to like the pace and character of innovation. So I don't know what to do about that. You know what to do about that? Suppose we made you czar of the world. What would you do about this?
So in a fictive world, I would, if I had one day time.
It's real, you know, right here for this space.
Czar, I would institute Sunday in the middle of the week. You know, I would try to find ways to slow things down for everyone, give people spaces to have, you know, personal relations again, to reflect on their lives, remove opportunities for quick consumption benefits, for the quick hype of consumption, right? Force people not to be able to consume and experience what that might feel like, right? Maybe this helps, or maybe it's actually may create an unintentional negative side effects. I don't know.
Well, we might ask a slightly different question. If we allowed you to travel in time, where would you want to go back to? Now, a guy I admire is Daniel Quinn, who invented this ape Ishmael. Who tells humans what a disaster they made of the earth for the rest of the flora and fauna, and he would take us back to roughly Cain and Abel. That is, when we gave up hunter gathering and started agriculture. So that would be a pretty radical place for your time travel to take you. But is there some more moderate place where you could really go back, and if you could change policies, it would really make the world now a much better place?
Not really. I'm not nostalgic about that. You know, I have this nostalgic feeling about my childhood and how simple everything was, sure. But I really wouldn't want to go back then. I think we need to learn to live with what we have and where we are, rather than thinking about getting to the future faster or traveling back in time somehow. Mm-hmm. We got to learn to deal with our problems now and make an effort to understand them and accept them and appreciate what is good, and not just always hoping for a better future and using innovation to build that. So I want to stay where I am.
There's an email from somebody. I think it's a really good email, and it's related to John's kind of question, because I wonder if there are alternative ways of being. Andrea in San Francisco asks, what about a company like Patagonia that seems to be trying to be productive as a company but preserve the environment at the same time? For example, they make jackets designed to last a lifetime and encourage recycling if you should decide you don't want it anymore. Isn't that a corporate innovation that is useful? And could there be more models of, you know, production and consumption?
Exactly. That's what we talked about earlier. So thanks for bringing up Patagonia. This is a B corporation. This is what we already talked about. There are alternative ways of governing capital and ideas and people and resources for different types of ends, right? Not just for financial returns, but by being considerate about a much broader impact, both positive and negative. And Patagonia is a great example of a company that at least tries to do that. Are they sustainable? Probably not, but they are much less unsustainable than other companies.
But they might be more sustainable if we had adopted public policies, economic policies designed to encourage and reward companies like that. So we as a collective could say, hey, this is a burden we want you to take on, and here's how we'll compensate. Instead of tax benefits to bring in job-cutting, union-busting companies, tax benefit to bring in sustainable forms of industry or something like that. What do you think about stuff like that?
No, again, legal constraints matter. Top-down regulation, this matters deeply, but we are really good at screwing legal systems. So I'm not sure whether this is the way out.
Well, I mean, I'm convinced capital, the use of capital, the profit motive, are all parts of a reasonable human existence. But I do kind of think it's got on at hand. And I think the idea of these big corporations, which really goes back to the first corporations that Britain, I guess, recognized, a corporation should really not just use its social benefits as advertising that it makes up. They should really have a charter that makes them responsible to the people in general and not just the stockholders and investors.
So, you know, capitalism with a human face could help us with the environment. It could help us with the pace of innovation and the downside consequence. It could help us manage all kinds of things, it seems to me. You know what, Kristen, I'm going to have to thank you for joining. I'd love to have you back someday to talk about how we could have capitalism with a more sustainable basis, because that's kind of what we were getting into. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun. Great.
Our guest has been Kristen Salos. He's a visiting scholar at Stanford's Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. He's author of the forthcoming Innovation and Scaling for Impact, How Effective Social Enterprises Do It. So, John, what are your innovative thoughts? You're a pretty innovative philosopher. Yeah. What are your innovative thoughts?
I make up new concepts, new words for old ideas all the time. It's, you know, the way I keep writing. I just think there's big problems here about about ethical problems, but conceptual problems about how we should think about ethics. Because I think the temptation to think about what's good for the world in the guise of what I would like, what I would be comfortable with, what would make me happier, what would have helped my family, it's natural, and there's some truth to it. But you have to do more radical thinking if you're really thinking about what's the world going to be like. And you have to realize that the particular things you like because of your place and time aren't necessarily parts of any conceivable good life. So that's my pompous thought.
I that's related, I think, to our incapacity or lack of inclination to think about the aggregated cost and benefits of all the individual decisions we make. And there really aren't very many social mechanisms for thinking in the aggregates. And, you know, I think it's definitely true that we need to reform our social life so we can think more about these aggregated things and take intelligent collective action. So I think that's a challenge of the 21st century. But you know what? Challenges of the 21st century we address in this conversation. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is a really old-fashioned one, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. And please join us at the community on Wednesday, November 18th at 1 p.m. Pacific for a live online chat with today's guest, Kristen Salos.
Now let's hear from a real innovator in diction. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we live in an age not so much of innovation, but of deadly fear that we are not innovating. Fortunately for the status quo, the bar for innovation is pretty low. You can order a taxi over the internet. That spawned a multi-billion dollar startup. You can rent rooms in your house over the internet. That also spawned a multi-billion dollar startup. Not exactly inventing the wheel, is it? But the weird thing is, in warnings about factors standing in the way of innovation, there is never any talk of innovation being killed or demolished or strangled in its sleep or destroyed utterly like Atlantis. No, the threat is always stifling. We could stifle innovation, like stick innovation in a hot room with the windows closed. I guess stifling could lead to death, but I always think of it as what you do with a cough at a concert, or a wise guy remark to somebody who could fire you, or a sneeze at a silent prayer. You repress it. It's a temporary smothering. Innovation can be hampered or hindered, but never stopped. The agencies of stifling seem to come in clusters. There are 9 ways to stifle innovation. There are 4 ways to stifle innovation. Here are 11 rules for you to follow. Read this listicle and create your own mental PowerPoint. Before you know it, you'll be innovating till the cows come home, which won't be till dawn. Thanks to this innovative diet plan for cows, which keeps them away from home on your schedule, not theirs. The internet is full of this stuff. As a favor to you, and to save you precious Google time, I will now share some of the innovation impediments revealed to me when I Googled stifle innovation. Here are some stifling agents: trial lawyers, bureaucrats, diffuse leadership, rigid business practices. Watch out for ineffective delegation, micromanaging, unconstructive criticism, and discouragement of diversity. Other stiflers include Syngenta lawsuits, the Feinstein Bill, vendor liability, universal health care, royalty-free standards, Obama, of course, corporatism, net neutrality, ride-sharing restrictions, financial analysts, corporate culture, human nature, intolerance for risk, HR, strong religious beliefs, management that's too visionary, high salaries, privacy, invasive social media, government surveillance, FDA, the mortgage crisis, drone, no-fly zones, health regulations, the need for certainty, efficiency, punishing failure, blaming, shaming, bigotry, and in one analysis I've read of National Public Radio, reruns of Car Talk, because they take up hours better spent with innovative programs like, well, I blush. Overthinking is another stifler. As a matter of fact, one of the memes of innovation is once we get out of the way, it's easy, or at least not brain surgery. Brain surgery used to run neck and neck with rocket science as the thing other things were not, but now it's pretty much brain surgery all the time. Perhaps because we have Ben Carson on the public stage, who is an actual brain surgeon, leading to all kinds of jokes. But really, how hard can brain surgery be? It's not like it's running for president. See what I did there? Pretty innovative kind of joke, if you ask me. Disrupt humor. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topete, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Right now, it's only a notion, but I think I can get money to make it into a concept and then later turn it into an idea.